maybe your life has been for nothing, but your death has made us filthy rich.
Would you guys get all this?
Well, remember back in high school when you weren't in the greatest shape and you ran that 4-hour mile? Well, some friends would have encouraged you to eat healthier and exercise, but we decided to keep our mouths shut and take out a life insurance policy on you.
It's ghost sickness.
Ghost sickness?
Yeah.
God, no.
Yeah. I don't even know what that is.
But it might be fun to be a doctor, don't you think?
Why does a doctor need that little office for, anyway? There's books, little stupid aquarium. I guess he doesn't want people to see him looking stuff up. What the hell was that? That was kind of gross. That wasn't the tube or the circle.
Doctor, doctor, please.
Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's the Wednesday house call. Taking health-related questions at 521-TALK, star 580 on Bell Mobility, or 1-800-580-CFRA, and welcome back.
Thank you.
It's great to see you.
Good to see you,
and
too.
And Deborah has already called in from Dunrobin. Go ahead, Deborah.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
I listened to your program on Sunday, and I currently take a tranquilizer. It's a clonazepam.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned an alternative medication, and I didn't get the name nor the spelling.
Oh, it was called Buspirone. Buspirone.
B-U-S?
B-U-S.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to spell it out too. P-I-R.
P-I-R-O-N-E.
And it's used to treat anxiety. The issue, though, for you, Deborah, is that you've already taken clonazepam.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of the problem is that when someone has been taking the class of medications known as benzodiazepines,
yes,
of which clonazepam is one of them, it doesn't work. Using buspirone doesn't work as well.
It doesn't.
Because the area in the nerve that the clonazepam binds to is also a similar area where the buspirone will bind, and it changes how it binds. So it may not be as effective. It may be worth trying if you speak to your physician, but you may find that it doesn't have the same effect. It works better in people who have never used benzodiazepines before, mm-hmm, as opposed to those who are currently taking them.
Well, I'd like to give anything a try. So I think I will mention it the next time I'm in.
Okay, and it is a medication, unfortunately, that's not covered.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I
understand. So that's the other issue.
Do you know, is it expensive?
I don't know the cost. I do know that for 2 weeks worth, it runs probably close to about $30 for 2 weeks.
Okay, that's what I figured.
And people typically take these medications for?
It's to treat generalized anxiety.
Anxiety.
It's an adjunct. I mean, it can be used in combination with other medications to treat anxiety disorders. I find, though, that for some people it works quite well, and it also doesn't have the same, in fact, it doesn't have any habit-forming potential,
mm-hmm,
or dependency potential as the benzodiazepines do. And this came up on Sunday, Rob, because of a patient of mine whom it works well for her. She's on government assistance. She's working and she's functioning reasonably well. And they don't cover it. So I made an application to ask for it to be covered because I want to avoid using the benzodiazepines for reasons of, again, habituation and tolerance and stuff. And they refused once. I wrote again saying, we've already tried it. It's working. It's helping her. She's functioning. She's at work. And they refused again. They won't cover it at all.
That's terrible.
Well, somebody's got to pay for those, orange motorcycles, I
yes,
guess.
Yes, I guess so.
Now, I was wondering, in conjunction with antidepressants,
mm-hmm,
is it effective? Or?
That's exactly the combination where it would be used, is in conjunction with an antidepressant, especially since antidepressants do help to treat anxiety disorders or anxiety as part of a depression complex. And then using that as an adjunct can be helpful. There are other medications that can also be used with antidepressants that can help with anxiety. Another one is called Topamax that can be used in conjunction with antidepressants. So there are a few other medications that are available that are used in combination that also don't have the tolerance or the dependency associated with them.
With the benzodiazepines.
Right.
Okay.
All right, Deborah.
All right, thank you very much.
Best of luck to you.
Have a good day.
Yep. Bye-bye. Every phone line available right now, folks. 521-TALK, star 580 on Bell Mobility, or 1-800-580-CFR. A perfect time for you to call if you have a health-related question. So the little ones are back in the classroom.
Yes, they are.
Reports out in the last few days, since school is back, that this is typically the worst month for asthma.
It's called week 38.
Week 38,
yes,
okay.
Yes, the 38th week of the year, beginning from January, not the school year. Typically, you see a peak in asthma exacerbation.
Okay. And what's going on?
There are several factors. With children clustered in classrooms, you now will have a greater chance of passing cold viruses amongst all the kids, and that tends to happen.
Okay.
And that will exacerbate the asthma attack. Other things, children that have allergies to ragweed, ragweed season picks up pretty much. It starts in August, sort of starts to peak more in September and runs through to the end of October.
Okay.
Depending on the ventilation systems in the schools, you can have and where the schools are located. If they're near fields, children can tend to have more asthma attacks. But it's primarily it's the viruses that tend to do that. They tend to catch that. So the idea is to always, for children that have a history of asthma with a known history and the pattern of it getting worse when they get to school, to start their medications 2 weeks before they actually go to school. So that way you mitigate or reduce the severity of the asthma attack, because they still may get their asthma attack, but it won't be as severe because they already have stuff on board to suppress their reaction. But it's a constant, well-established pattern that you see every single year.
Right. So obviously parents would know about it already and be able to prepare.
Yeah, they're usually aware. Parents are pretty good at knowing when their kids are at risk of asthma. They've seen the patterns, especially for children that are older. They have longstanding asthma conditions. They know the patterns, and they usually make those preparations beforehand.
David is up next. David?
Hi.
Hi, David.
Hi. I have a question about bowel.
Mm-hmm.
When a person's bowel movements are like a rabbit, and have consisted now for a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor recommended Metamucil and salads.
Right.
Nothing has changed.
Well, I guess it's a matter of, in terms of stool pattern, it's a matter of whether this causes, if there's any associated pain or the frequency of bowel movements is impinging upon work environment or having to take too many breaks. If, on the other hand, the bowel movement is essentially normal, it's just the consistency of the stool is different, but there's been no other significant changes, it's not necessarily something that has to be treated. It's only if it's causing pain or cramping, or if there's constipation, something along the lines that interferes with the normal day-to-day activities. So I'm not sure if that pattern has done that to you, or whether it's just the change that's of concern.
Just the change that's of concern. There's no pain. Only thing I do is sit and watch TV.
Okay.
So, other than the sitting, I thought maybe that, you know, watching for 3-4 hours at a time.
Yeah, not necessarily, but, you know, stool pattern and stool consistency is usually related to the type of foods that are being consumed. I'm not a huge fan of taking the Metamucils and such. There are lots of foods that can contribute to normal bowel patterns, you know, things such as grapes, raisins, corn, oats, apples.
Oatmeal works for me. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, you know, so there are different foods in it, and it's a matter of just experimenting. But if you're not in any pain, then, you know, I wouldn't start adding in Metamucil or other things, because nothing is really broken. It's just a different pattern.
Well, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I thank you very much. And Rob Snow, you're probably the greatest guy on radio in Canada or the United States.
Oh, he's blushing now.
You know what, David? You're probably the smartest listener who's ever called this radio station, David. Thank you so much for that.
That's very nice.
It is very nice. I take that to heart. Peter.
Yes.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
So I have a question for you. I had a month ago, or probably over a month ago, I had a kind of stomach flu.
Mm-hmm.
Days, and after 3 days, I start to feel like a chest pain or burning sensation.
Mm-hmm.
So I called 1-800 number to find out, what should I do? And after being, a minute with the nurse on the phone,
mm-hmm.
That the ambulance is on its way. So I was taken to the Winchester Hospital.
Right.
They did the blood test on me, and the troponin level was, and are you sitting now there?
Yeah.
2.68.
Okay.
The normal level, as you probably know, is 0.08.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was elevated.
It was elevated substantially. So what they did, I waited a couple of days for to have angiogram.
Right.
They sent me to Civic Hospital. Of course, everybody told me I had a heart attack, right?
Right.
They sent me to the Civic. In the Civic, the angiogram was perfect. The doctor said I haven't seen a healthy heart like that for mm-hmm. 8 years.
So, okay, so what's your question, Peter, just because we're a little short on time? What's your question?
My question is, and of course they let me go. They said nothing happened, but, I'm still concerned about the troponin level, and nobody can explain to me.
Okay, let's listen to the doctor then.
Well, the problem is that you can't depend on one lab value as a marker for heart attack. Troponin levels can increase from other conditions
as well.
What is
it? What is this?
Troponin is a compound that's released from muscle, in this case, heart tissue, and is used as a marker to see if there's been damage to the heart muscle.
Okay.
So that's essentially what that is.
So if it's elevated, it would represent what?
Then? It would represent cardiac trauma, trauma to the heart.
All right.
But you don't necessarily have to have that. You can have troponin levels that increase from other areas of the body where there's some damage. So that's part of the issue.
Okay.
So from the flu that he had, the stomach flu, he could have had some injuries to other muscle tissue and end up having some of this elevation. So the
which could also explain the elevated troponin level.
Right. The fact that he had an angiogram, which is a gold standard to look for the coronary arteries to see if there's any blockage, there was none.
Okay.
And the electrocardiogram, I'm assuming, didn't show anything in the emergency
room. Let's ask him. Electrocardiogram, Peter, what did it say?
Everything was perfect.
Yeah,
was
so perfect. It was not your heart. So it was elevated, but it was the troponins didn't represent an area from the heart. So you can get false positive results as when you do this, when this happens. So that's why one lab test can lead to a whole bunch of other tests that do not necessarily mean that there's any problem.
But what you would trust more than an elevated troponin level is the fact that he has had an angiogram and an EKG, and both of which show no damage or trauma.
That's right.
That's what you would rely on.
Yeah, he had direct visualization of the arteries, which were normal, and an EKG, which showed no evidence of any cardiac damage through the electrical conduction through the heart.
Now, that those troponin levels, would you expect them to lower on their own, or is there
it'll go down. It's usually some acute damage, and he did have something that was going on that can essentially contaminate the result.
Okay.
And so that's likely what happened. The fact that he had a normal angiogram and normal EKG means that he did not have a heart attack. That's essentially the conclusion from that.
Okay. Good luck to you, Peter. More of your phone calls after the news. If you're on the line, stay on the line. We will get to your phone calls, but not until after the 3:30 news. James has a question about Ciprolex and Adrian ferritin levels and bursitis for John. And a lot to talk about right after the news.
Here we are.
I'm Hadley, internal medicine. And Dr. Lafong, communicable diseases. Dr. Boyer, bacteriology. And Dr. Stinson, Marston and Gill of the Northampton Trauma Institute, and Dr. Imhouse of the Zurich Relief Fund. These are our newly arrived surgeons, Drs. Trowbridge and Greenbaum.
Doctor?
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 And doctor. Well, we miss anyone?
Doctor?
Rob?
Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's the Wednesday House Call, 521 Talk, star 580, 1-800-580-CFRA. That's Dr. Rob, do you? Adrian.
Good afternoon.
Hi, afternoon.
Adrian. Yes, I just got back from the doctor a couple of weeks back, and my blood work is all fine except for one thing. I'm 41, and the she told me that my ferritin levels were my ferritin level was too high, and she kind of gave me an explanation which I didn't understand, saying that it was a concern, and I'm just wondering what exactly does that mean, and what could cause it, and why should I be concerned?
How? What was the number that they gave?
Oh, I didn't. I don't know what it was
because
she sent me back for it. She gave me another requisition, and it just had the ferritin X'd out, and that was the only thing.
Okay.
So she's going to send me back again.
Well, ferritin is a it's essentially a marker for iron concentration in your blood.
Okay.
And there are certain levels. Normal level for men is upper level of normal is up to 300. And so you have to look at how much more above 300 it is going to be. Sometimes you'll see levels of 400 or 500. And the most common causes for those, other than just having too much iron in your diet, is sometimes there's inflammation of the liver. People who consume alcohol can have that happen. Obesity is another cause of it. Having elevated cholesterol or having high levels of cholesterol and triglycerides in your bloodstream can do that. Having high blood pressure and also people who have insulin resistance or are diabetic can also cause elevated levels of this compound. The issue is to determine whether this represents a condition known as iron overload or hemochromatosis. And hemochromatosis...
Oh, yeah, I can tell you just by the sounds of it, you don't want it.
It with elevated iron levels and with hemochromatosis, what happens is the iron has very little place to go, so it embeds itself in various tissues. And one of the tissues that it'll embed itself in is heart muscle. And over time, that can cause damage to the heart in terms of how it's able to function, and your cardiac function can diminish over time. However, again, levels of 400 or 500 do not necessarily represent hemochromatosis. Usually you see values of 800 or 900 in those situations, which is why it's important to find out exactly what the value was. If there's a family history of hemochromatosis, it makes it a little bit more significant. The other issue is, in order to determine whether this actually does represent hemochromatosis, is that there's another blood test that is done to prove or disprove whether that's the case. And the test is called a transferrin saturation. So TRANSFERRIN. A transferrin saturation, it comes as a percent. And if that is high and your ferritin level is high, and again, your physician's going to have to look at that number and determine whether it truly is. If it's 330 or 350, I wouldn't call that anything I would worry about. If it's 600 or 700, in the context of this transferrin level as well being elevated, then that tends to increase the suspicion for a condition called hemochromatosis. But if the transferrin level is normal, then it's likely to be more, you know, liver disease or inflammation. Even people getting viruses and colds or just being sick for a while can have elevated ferritin levels. Mm. And so you want to check the ferritin level again just to see if it's going down. And more often than not, it tends to normalize over time. So this is, again, another reason for, you know, unless there's a specific suspicion that there's a problem, doing blood tests for reasons that are unclear only create other issues that, for the most part, end up not being clinically relevant. And so you end up now having to worry if you have something or not. And when the likelihood is that you probably don't have hemochromatosis.
Okay, so basically, I think I know what you're saying in terms of, because I used to be a rather heavy drinker.
Mm-hmm.
And then so I quit drinking about 2 months ago.
Yeah.
And now, is there any hope for me if I keep on that?
It's amazing. If you give your liver a chance to recover, your liver can completely heal.
Okay.
And so the ferritin level is likely, if you had a heavy drinking history, that certainly is a significant factor in this level. And it does take time for the level to come down. I mean, you've had one point on the graph with one specific blood test. So the next ferritin level that's done a couple of months down the road If it's lower, it also tells you that whatever the initial cause was is now diminished as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's having stopped, your liver has a chance to recover, and it usually will recover.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for
good
your
luck,
help.
Adrian.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
John in Ottawa. John, thanks for waiting, John.
Oh, you're welcome. Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I suffer from bursitis, and just lately, it's like a warming sensation around my joint.
Mm-hmm.
I've never experienced that before. I'm just wondering if that's something I should worry about.
Is it interfering with function?
No.
If it and it's localized on the side of your leg, up near your hip. Is that where it is?
Hip and down the back side of my thigh.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like someone's pouring water over it. You know.
Mm-hmm. And it just sort of burns all the
it
way down
burns,
the leg.
But it's not uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Only when I sit down and put pressure on the joint. It seems to intensify the I won't call it burning, I'll call mm-hmm. the warmth.
Now, this just started?
Just started.
Right. So, was there any activity or anything that you may have done over the past few days that would have stressed joint?
I did a lot of walking.
Yeah.
And that might have done it.
Yeah. So, in this case, it's not necessarily bursitis, because bursitis implies the bursa, which is essentially a small little sack filled with fluid, acts as a cushion that usually sits on top of areas of bone that are very sharp, so that it allows the normal tendons and the muscle that runs over the joint itself, the tendons from that muscle, to glide over the surface instead of getting sort of scraped by the edge of the joint or the bone. And so sometimes if there is damage to the bursa, usually it's from a fall or from an impact or overstraining, that bursa, in this case, that'd be one over the hip, that bursa would get swollen and it would hurt, but it would stay localized in the area where it was damaged. If you're having pain that radiates down the leg or the sensation that's radiating down the leg, it's more likely the muscle and connective tissue as opposed to the bursa itself that's damaged. And in any event, the fact that this happened after a lot of walking probably means that you've strained the area, you've torn some of the tissue. It is going to be uncomfortable for a while, but you still should stay active, not pushing yourself too much, but staying active to keep the muscle strong. And it should in itself recover on its own. There really isn't much to do other than stay active and keep moving the joint. But more than that, I wouldn't really start, you know, you can certainly take over-the-counter medications for any discomfort if it's really bothering you.
No, but, it's not. It's not really bothering me. It's just something I never felt before.
Yeah, and you likely pulled something.
Okay.
And the fact that it happened right after and it happened suddenly means mm-hmm. that you're not dealing with a significant arthritic change, because it happened right away. Arthritis happens over many months to years of use.
Mm-hmm.
And since you were feeling fine before and this happened yes. right afterwards, it yes. likely is just a small trauma that happened that'll heal up on its own.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Good luck, John. Well, surprise, surprise, eating organic food is no healthier than eating the average stuff that people have been eating for years.
There's a Stanford University study that looked at, they tried to find quality studies to review, and they found 17 on human health and another 230 on the differences between the nutritional value of these foods, and found there was no difference in nutritional value, no difference in the effect on health.
Hmm.
What they did find is that the pesticide residue was less on the organic food, but it was less of a percentage of a minuscule amount. So if you have parts per billion on North American produce and you have 30% less of parts per billion, it's still a fraction of parts per billion. So really, it wasn't that significant in that way. The main issue they found was that for bacteria that contaminated the fruits and vegetables, both the organic and the conventional products had similar rates of contamination. The difference being is that those that were grown conventionally tended to have bacteria that had multi-antibiotic resistance because of the animals that were fed with lots of antibiotics. And so that's a concern. There's less of that going on now. I think they're cracking down on that a bit more, and I think they should. But in terms of the cost, as far as I'm concerned, looking at the cost of things and the people that are, you know, the health effects on people, it's just if you want to buy organic and you feel better doing it, you know, that's your choice. But from a scientific perspective, there isn't any significant difference from the nutritional quality or the effect on your health.
Any reaction to the Canadian Medical Association Journal editorial that says spanking is poor parenting? Parents should use other parenting tactics other than spanking, and that they have volumes of data that shows that spanking can lead to more aggressive behavior, emotional, behavioral problems, and substance abuse. There are links there.
Well, I think it's a matter of context, and if they have the information to show that, then they have to show under what conditions the spanking led to that. Were these children that were literally beaten every day, where I would imagine, yes, it's going to affect you? Were these children that were spanked once in their lives, twice? At what age were they spanked? So you have to, I think we have to tease those numbers out to see exactly what they mean. And I would say that if they're saying that frequent spanking on a regular basis or beating your children, that's different
obviously
things,
there's
right?
a difference so, there between
that's right. So we have to, you know, when you use the word spanking can mean a lot of things to people. So I think it's important to know exactly what they mean by that. My own view is that I don't think spanking is necessary to raise your children. But again, I grew up in a home where we had a thing called Mother's Voice, which was literally a strap that was hanging on the wall. So I wasn't spanked.
Did you hear Mother's Voice very often?
Not very often. It was just seeing it hanging on the wall.
Well, you know, we took a couple of calls who said, you know what, it just the threat was enough to scare them straight sometimes.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's a generational
thing too, right?
Yeah.
For younger parents now, I think they view spanking as unnecessary. Whereas when I was being raised and when my father was being raised, and people of a certain, what I call vintage, that was the norm.
Yeah,
that's what you did.
The technique they used to impose limits was by spanking, but now there are other ways to impose limits without spanking that were not necessarily known then. It's like watching Mad Men. You ever watch a show, Mad Men?
Oh, sure, Mad Men.
Yeah, and you look at you see some of the things, kids running around with plastic bags over their head playing with it as a toy. You know, you look at it now and you go, what is
that? Well, there's a scene in Mad Men, actually, where the kids are running around the house and not even the father, but the neighbor grabs the little kid and smacks him across the face and tells him to behave.
Yeah, yeah. So very different.
Whereas if that happened today in 2012, well, that adult would probably be in the back of a police cruiser.
Yeah, so it was very, very different approach. And I think that's, you're absolutely right. It's a generational thing. And there are many other approaches to raising children than trying to impose limits by smacking them.
Okay, good to see you today.
You too.
You're back in on Sunday with the Sunday House Call?
Back in on Sunday.
All right, Sunday's at 4 here on CFRA. Health Headlines, 10 minutes to 7 during Madeley in the morning and every Wednesday afternoon with me.